Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the London Bureau Chief at Global Capital.
And I'm John Hay, Corporates, Markets and Sustainability Editor.
This week we'll be talking to our senior emerging markets reporter George Collard about a sudden spurt of issuance in the Gulf from local borrowers both in the Sukuk and conventional bond markets. We'll talk about what's driving it and what's about to stop it. We'll also be taking a look at the UK's latest step to increase retail issuance in the gilt market. That's been something of a theme, sovereign bonds being sold to retail issuers over the last year or so. When interest rates rocketed, banks didn't really bother putting up their interest on their savings accounts, which allowed some sovereigns to do some very impressive deals indeed. So we'll be talking a little bit about the future of that. And we'll also be talking about a new environmental finance campaign, a story you've written about, John. But first, I wanted to ask you about the covered bond market, because there's been a swell of investment from a particular group of buyers, hasn't there?
Yes, and this is another effect, as many of these things are, of the changes in interest rates. Suddenly, covered bonds, which are, you know, without being rude, the most boring asset class in the private sector debt market.
I think they see that as a compliment, to be honest.
Well, exactly. I don't actually mean they're boring, but they are the least yieldy. You know, these are for investors who really, you know, want no risk, minimal return and ultimate safety. And so typically, you know, during the long period when interest rates were very low, these didn't appeal to, you know, large swathes of the investor base, particularly asset managers who are, you know, fundamentally channeling retail money. I mean, they did still buy them, but it was sort of diminished. And the sort of core investor base very much were bank treasuries, which, you know, banks are not there for yield. They are buying to basically have something where to park liquidity, which earns them a few basis points, and sort of, you know, just keeps their cash, you know, safely housed. So, but that of course has all changed. The European Central Bank has not only put up interest rates but exited the market of covered bonds, which it used to be buying aggressively, further pushing down yields, and therefore, you know, yields have come up nicely on them. And, you know, there's been quite a lot of issuance recently. All the deals we looked at this week through our reporter Frank Jackman were paying yields of over 3.1%. And at that level, asset managers are interested.
Yeah, so give us a flavour then for what, how much of a deal they were buying before to how that has changed now, because it really is quite startling, isn't it?
Well, it's startling for covered bonds. The statistics, when you look at them, are almost startlingly dull, but they've gone from 22% of the average book in 2022, which was a low, to 28% this year. Now, that may not sound very exciting, but that is, of course, an average. And the you know, on specific deals, it can be much more extreme. Like this week, we had a deal from UBS, the Swiss bank, a 1 billion euro 5-year, which is a sort of non-standard covered bond. It's not based on a legal framework, but on contractual rights, and therefore it's a bit funky, and doesn't rely on a sort of very traditional investor base. And this deal went more than 60% to asset managers. So, you know, they particularly like the more funky stuff, in a sense, and that's partly because they're more flexible. Banks are often, you know, quite hidebound in what they can buy. They have long processes internally to kind of onboard a new issuer and decide that it's okay to buy it. They often, you know, they don't really want risk, whereas asset managers are after risk that pays them well.
And what kind of effect is this having on covered bond syndications overall? What's it doing for the size of order books?
Oh, it's great. I mean, the issuers are loving it. The order books are bigger. You're getting more, they're sort of more dynamic. We're finding that issuers are tending to behave slightly more like they do in, say, the corporate bond market, with, you know, putting the pricing a bit wider at the beginning of the book build and then cranking it in more. They're getting big books where they're able to tighten that pricing a lot. And then the bonds are tending to perform after pricing by tightening in the secondary market. And, you know, to some in the cover bond market, this feels a bit sort of infradig. And, you know, there are sort of mumblings that deals might have been mispriced if they tighten too much after being priced, because that looks a bit like the issuer, you know, left a few basis points on the table. Heaven forbid. But actually, of course, that's exactly the kind of thing that asset managers and the more dynamic investors really want. You know, when they buy bonds, they like there to be a bit of performance in the secondary market, because it just sort of juices up the overall return.
It must be a question of degree, though, because, yeah, like, you know, you want to leave investors feeling good about having bought the deal and getting a bit of performance and so on, and compensating them adequately for the risk and all that other stuff. But you don't want to be needlessly giving money away. Now, in the covered bond market, if memory serves, you might expect to tighten the deal maybe 4 or 5 basis points during execution. Maybe it performs a couple of basis points on the break. What's been happening recently?
Well, two examples Frank highlighted this week were the UBS Switzerland deal I mentioned before. That got a book of 7.4 billion euros. It was a debut as well in the format. And so that was about 7 times covered. And Ikrea Bank in Italy did a 500 million deal that was 10 times covered. Both of those were able to tighten by 12 basis points from their initial price thoughts and then perform after pricing as well.
You can see why there might be some criticism of starting too cheap. You know, if you end up with these huge order books and these huge degrees of tightening and then performance in the secondary market, I mean, those are all things you want, but just to a lesser degree in a market that's, you know, where the product is not completely homogenous between deals, but there's a lot of the deals have a lot in common and they're well understood. And it's, you know, as you said at the start, it's meant to be this sort of boring low yield low spread product. I mean, do we have a sense of how much performance has been generally, and do you think any of that criticism is fair about mispricing? I mean, actually, there's one thing that strikes me is that often over the last couple of years we've been told, and this is partly because of the distortion to the market caused by ECB buying that you mentioned earlier, that the secondary market just isn't really a particularly liquid place, and that prices aren't a very good indication of where a new issue could come. So I suppose you can always base your pricing off of the last most recent new issue rather than where bonds are trading. But do we have a bit more sympathy perhaps for banks that are sort of embarking on a brave quest for price discovery in uncharted waters perhaps?
I certainly have plenty of sympathy for people who think that the sensible way to go is to put plenty of spread on the table and then crank it in if there's lots of demand. It seems to me a perfectly rational way of organizing a book build, and I don't really have sympathy for sort of grumbling and moaning that something's mispriced just because it's successful. I think it's a bit odd when in a market that, you know, is traditionally sort of bought by only a narrow group of investors, and then for a long time had the ECB taking up to 40% of every deal, which, you know, made people grumble even more, to complain when there's a whole flood of eager new investors in the market. So, you know, fundamentally, it's very good for covered bonds to be getting this new interest, and if the if these investors are a bit more exuberant and sort of pile in, you know, jostling each other a bit, shouting for bonds, I think it's all to the good. After all, you know, a book build is essentially an auction. You know, the investors show up. You know, you never quite know how much demand there's going to be on the day, and the tightening process that goes on during a book build is precisely there to, you know, reach a clearing level where you know, you weed out some of the, you know, the more price sensitive demand, and you get to the keenest investors.
But John, pity the humble borrower, if you will, who's paying exorbitant fees to banks for, you know, the best advice and the best execution and getting these deals as tightly priced as possible. The dealer banks are surely supposed to know the market and what investors want well enough to be able to put a razor sharp pricing. Otherwise, what is the issuer paying for?
Well, I mean, you're talking with a very SSA and cover bond mindset, and you know, I think which is fine, and you know, it is that sort of product. But I think, you know, inevitably, when something is, you know, if it is very finely priced, the number of investors is very stable. It's, you know, there's nothing much going on in the market. It's just the same as it always has been. Then you can demand, you know, razor sharp and precision pricing. But when things get a bit more lively, you know, and rates have gone up, there's more investors interested, you know, it's a bit more exposed, and you know, there's going to be more variety. Another interesting aspect, actually, that Frank highlighted in his story was that, you know, the different types of questions the investors are asking. Now, you know, cover bonds are very much seen as a rates product, which fundamentally means that the investors don't really think about the credit of the issuer much, and they just sort of using it as a play on interest rates. And, you know, if they're AAA rated bonds, then, you know, there's a lot to be said for that approach. But the investors that are coming in now, the asset managers, are from a credit background. They're used to asking questions about the credits, and so banks are finding that you know, they're asking questions about what are the properties in the cover pools for the cover bonds, like, you know, how much hotels and office and retail properties they've got, and sort of credit questions like that, which are, you know, again, a sort of fresh sort of current in the market.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's a good point, isn't it? These are new times in the bond market. It's not just a renewed interest in underlying credit, as you suggest, and new buyers attracted by higher rates and so on. I suppose we also have to bear in mind the effect of the ECB, not just in terms of its bond buying or lack of bond buying now, which raises the question of how the market will absorb the bonds that are being issued, but also in terms of banks specifically, you know, covered bonds are issued by banks. The roll-off of the cheap liquidity offered to banks, well, over years recently, is now all rolling off, and that has to be refinanced in the market somewhere. So perhaps despite all those huge order books and all the rest of it, maybe it is a bit of a slightly riskier time than we perhaps give credit for.
Well, it's certainly an much more interesting market where, you know, credit distinction has come back to the fore, as a lot of bankers and investors hoped it would when the ECB finally retreated. And, you know, you've got at the moment real live questions about credit. You know, I mentioned real estate. Obviously, a lot of cover bonds are based on mortgages, and therefore, you know, it connected to real estate, even though, you know, these are very safe instruments. There's doubts about the health of the property sector, and, you know, you've got live debate about which way rates are going. So it's an interesting capital market at the moment, and I think, you know, therefore you get interesting deals.
Well, anyone who wants to read about that in greater detail can go to Frank's story, which is called AM's Pile into Covered Bonds with Zeal. That's up on our homepage as of now. So do head over there. And if you don't subscribe already, then take out a trial and you'll be able to read it for free. I'll tell you what another interesting vein of deals has been in this sort of new market of higher rates, and that's been retail targeted sovereign bonds. The UK this week gave retail investors a chance to buy into its gilt auctions, which it had not really made that easy before. I mean, there was a way of doing it up until the pandemic, but then that particular method was scrapped, and now it's making a further effort to do so. And our colleague Georgie Lee, who is our SSA bond reporter, has written about that this week.
I guess maybe the best way to set the context for this is to think about what some of the other governments do, isn't it? Because particularly in the last couple of years, when interest rates have gone up again, There's been some quite spectacular retail bond issues by other governments, haven't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Italy has various buying retail bond schemes for its domestic retail investors, one of which is the BTP Valore. It began a new issue of those on Monday, and it's raised something like 18 billion euros each from the two of its previous issues in June and October 2023. So you can see just how big these are. As of Wednesday, the demand for the current BTP Valore that's being sold had already reached like 11 billion euros.
What other countries have been doing it, Ralph?
Well, Belgium is an interesting case in point. It had a lot of success with retail targeted deals last year. For example, in September, it raised 22 billion euros from one such deal. It obviously spotted an opportunity, I guess, that its banks weren't exactly ramping up interest rates on their current accounts, and took advantage to do a huge chunk of funding from its retail investors.
And what effects did that have?
Well, there were a couple that are worthy of mention, because although it might have been great for Belgium to get this sort of fairly short-term debt through the door, it sucked an awful lot of money out of the banks because depositors took their money out of their current accounts and they put it in the government bonds. So that wasn't really that great for Belgium's the security of Belgium's banking sector, that's for sure. And then another sort of disenfranchised group were the primary dealers for Belgium. Those are the investment banks that deal in its wholesale bond market that show up to buy the bonds at auctions and then hope for a fee-paying reward at its syndications, because obviously Belgium had done an awful lot of debt raising then through this retail sale that it didn't really need to do the syndications. And that really sort of had some complaining that it really needed to think long and carefully about how it raised this money, because they believe it has an interest in keeping its primary dealers motivated for the rest of the funding that it needs to do. Interestingly enough, Belgium is in the market at the moment with another retail targeted deal, and it's a little bit smaller than the 22 billion, that's for sure.
But I think that is probably because the Belgian government's decided to tax it, isn't it? And the difference is startling. I think Georgie spoke to the Belgian treasurer and he was putting a brave face on it, but they've got 400 or 450 million of demand yeah. at the moment, which compared with, you know, 6 and 22 billion is, you know, is paltry, isn't it? And that I think is mainly because there's 30% withholding tax.
Absolutely. I mean, it's worth mentioning too that there is now a 6 billion euro cap on all of these retail sales. I don't know how these deals tend to go through their book building, but it certainly doesn't look like it's going to trouble that number anytime soon.
No. So do you think the UK is watching what these other governments are doing and thinking it ought to do the same?
Well, the UK is doing something. There are a number of reasons why the UK gilt market is not going to turn into something that looks like Italy's or Belgium's bond markets anytime soon. But what it did do was it set up Winterflood Securities as its retail gilt edge market maker, and that company offered up what's called its retail access platform, which it stuck a W in front of, presumably for Winterflood so it could call it RAP, and it opened that up to a couple of retail facing investment platforms so that investors could place orders. The rather strange thing is that apparently for legal reasons we're not allowed to know how much was actually sold to retail investors in the end, so we don't know how significant this sale was.
We do know that they just said it was a lot more than they expected, which was they were allowed to describe it in relative but not absolute terms.
Yeah, so we don't, I mean, yes, we don't have much of a clue as to how much was actually placed or how much bigger it can become. I think, you know, in terms of its development, I think Sir Robert Steeman, who runs the Debt Management Office, said some interesting things, which was that it's really about culture in those countries when it comes to bond investment as much as anything else, as much as infrastructure and so on. And obviously the culture of investment in Belgium and Italy is very different to that in the UK, where people tend to buy property and shares.
Yes, I would hesitate to disagree with Sir Bob. However, I think if, you know, the culture is also what's available and is driven by that. And if the, you know, I mean, Belgian and Italian investors went off buying retail bonds for a long time when interest rates were low, and now they're high, they're buying them again. And I think if the UK could do a retail targeted bond issue, what I think is, you know, a bit puzzling is why, you know, why it should particularly need to. You know, the gilt market is obviously available to retail investors in the secondary market, so they can buy gilts if they want to. Is there any sort of specific advantage for them to buy a primary issue? Well, you know, not necessarily. I think what it could do is just simply by creating an event and doing a lot of marketing and sort of making a big thing out of it, you just get people to show up. And I think, and it sort of stimulates interest. And I think that's really what Belgium and Italy have done.
Yeah, and I thought you made an interesting point earlier in the week, John, when we were talking at our weekly editorial meeting, and that was that the government seems very keen to try and roll people's pensions and other investments into UK assets at the moment. And you made the point that perhaps doing a retail gilt might detract from those efforts. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I think by assets, it's a sort of more productive and risky end of the economy. I think the government is worried about the UK capital market. There's been a very weak market for stock market listings for several years, and you know that there are constant complaints that we don't invest enough in infrastructure and things like that. And the government and you know policymakers, people like the head of the stock exchange, are really trying to sort of think of ideas to juice up capital markets in the UK and get us investing in risky, productive things. And, you know, sucking a lot of retail money into, you know, gilts fundamentally and just sort of paying the national debt is, you know, maybe counteractive to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think I slightly prefer it to the suggestion that came out from the London Stock Exchange, is we just need to pay CEOs even more money.
but to get them to stay in the UK.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah. But I don't know. I suppose we'll see how this develops. Now, John, I want to say one word to you. Just one word. Are you listening?
Yes.
Plastics.
Right. Okay. Don't get me started.
Well, there's a great future in plastics. Yeah. Or not, as you've written this week, John. Finally, environmental finance has woken up to the peril of plastic. Tell us a bit about what's going on.
Yeah, so, I mean, ironically, given how visible and how well known, really, in society the problem of plastic is and plastic waste, it's received very little attention in the capital markets. And, you know, that's partly because it's such a difficult problem to tackle. It's not easy for anyone, and it's kind of negative for, you know, most players involved. If you think about the huge range of companies involved in the plastic supply chain, from you know, the fundamental oil producers, petrochemical companies that process the oil, you've got the packaging makers that make packaging and you know, and people who make other goods out of plastic. It's used in almost every conceivable kind of industry, in innumerable ways, from fibers to paints to coatings to toys and everything else. It's difficult for everybody to make changes, and therefore nobody really wants to talk about it, and that is finally beginning to change.
Yes, there's an initiative, and one bank has already signed it. You know, problem solved, isn't it? What's happened?
Well, full marks here to ING. We reported earlier this year on them being sued over climate in the Netherlands, but they are taking the lead here as the first financial institution to sign a call directed to the governments of the world, which are in the process of negotiating the Global Treaty on Plastics. And again, you know, few people in the capital markets are aware of this, but it could actually happen by the end of this year if it happens on schedule. This is meant to be the sort of third in a series of treaties, the first being the Paris Agreement on Climate in 2015. Then we had the Kunming Montreal Biodiversity Framework in 2022. And this one is tackling plastics. And it's supposed to come by the end of the year. Now, nobody knows yet how ambitious it's going to be and whether it's really sort of going to lead towards targets to reduce plastic use, you know, by percentages like the Paris Agreement did with its net zero commitment. But what we do know is that the UN has already agreed that it will be legally binding. So there is some sort of legally binding rules and framework coming. And the financial sector is beginning to feel that it ought to get involved.
Okay, I mean, normally how these things seem to have worked is actually the other way around. It usually seems to have been everyone else telling the banks that whilst they talk a good game when it comes to sustainability, they're actually still funding all the same stuff they were funding before. What good is it for a bank to sign this letter? I mean, it's a bit early, isn't it? Really, what will matter is what determinations are made about what banks can do to finance, you know, companies who produce too much plastic. Was there any sort of indication where that might be headed?
Yes. It is pretty early to expect banks to be sort of taking real action on this issue. And even ING told me that they, you know, we're not at the point yet where they're having sort of tough conversations with their clients and saying, look, you know, how's your plastic footprint coming on? Are you getting it down? Where's your target? You know, I'm not sure that's good enough. You know, those conversations are beginning to happen on climate, but not really on biodiversity yet, and certainly not on plastics. But the point of this statement and of the financial sector getting involved now, which began really last year with a group convened by the United Nations Environment Programme, and, you know, Allianz, the German insurance company, is also involved. So is Woori, the Korean financial group, and Bank Colombia in Colombia. The point of this is to try to make sure that the treaty, when it comes, is useful to the financial sector. The point being, they don't want it to be vague with kind of, you know, demands that are very hard to translate into real action. They want clear rules set for industry, for the, you know, all the real economy companies involved in plastic, so that they, as banks and insurance companies and investors, they know how to manage the issue. They know what to expect of their clients, what to look for. And it's this clarity that the financial sector is really calling for.
That's going to be hard to achieve, I sense. It's one thing regulating or, you know, laying down sort of conditions for financing the oil and gas industry, for example, or indeed regulating those industries themselves. They are, you know, they produce a specific thing. Actually, one of the things they produce is plastics. But plastic usage is just ubiquitous, isn't it? How on earth do you start to run sensible rules and tough conditions over that?
Well, of course, it's not unregulated as of now. There, you know, not through the financial sector, but industrially, there are rules about plastic and environmental use of it, and the, you know, for example, the labelling. You know, it's, you know, most of the common plastics on packaging, for example, are clearly labelled as what they are, which is meant to make recycling easier and so on. So, you know, the industry and the one good thing is that the plastics industry is not completely against reform and improvement. They, you know, I looked at what the European Plastics Association and the Plastics Industry Association in America are saying about it. They obviously, as you'd expect, are not on the same page as a Greenpeace or someone like that. But they are perfectly happy with the idea that plastic waste should be eliminated. And that we should move to a circular economy where, you know, all plastic basically gets recycled. And but it's how to achieve that with this product, which is so versatile, so light, so easy to turn into different forms and change by adding colours and different additives and so on. It's beginning to build up industry-wide frameworks to tackle these issues that is what's going to be needed.
Well, I suppose if there's one thing that didn't surprise me, it was that ING signed up first. I mean, it would have been headline if they hadn't been the first to sign up. But actually, isn't this just a hassle for banks and investment firms?
I think some will see it as a hassle. Some, unfortunately, now with being a bit of a backlash against the ESG in parts of the world, will see this as, you know, politically uncomfortable. And it was interesting that the statement that the UNEP have drafted is very careful to say that this, you know, this is not any form of collective action. It's banks or investors that sign it are doing it individually, and that's to kind of avoid the accusation that there's some kind of anti-competitive cabal, which is an accusation that conservatives have used against ESG initiatives. But I think the more fundamental point is that there's an opportunity here for banks and investment firms. First of all, there's an opportunity not to be caught out. And ING emphasised this quite clearly. They are sure that regulation is coming. There's a global legally binding treaty coming. It's going to affect banks and many of their clients. Why not get ahead of the game and sort of get up to speed on it and even start influencing how it is and trying to make the regulations actually work for you instead of just waiting until it comes along and then sort of calling your lawyer and asking you for guidance. So I think there's a point about getting on the front foot, but also this is a transition, just like the climate transition. There's going to be enormous investment needed to put in place the recycling facilities we need to actually stop throwing away 91% of our plastic as we're doing, with much of that ending up in the environment, and start recycling it, which is what the plastics industry wants, or even replacing plastic with alternatives which are more organic and not harmful to the environment.
Yeah, well, it sounds super exciting, but it does sound very, very early days. I wonder what the sort of final outcome will be, whether, you know, the final text will be sort of riddled with the fingerprints of, very much self-interested groups, or whether this will be a genuine full-on attempt to address the problem. And I guess you'll be keeping us abreast of that as we go along. Now, in a not entirely unrelated field in terms of hydrocarbons, we spoke to George Collard about a sudden spurt of issuance from the Gulf region and what that means and where it's headed. Good morning, George. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me on.
You've written a very interesting story this week about a sudden spurt of issuance in the Gulf. What's going on?
Effectively, it's not the only reason, but we have Ramadan coming up, which means issuers of a variety of different kinds, so sovereigns, banks, real estate companies from the Gulf region have all been sort of rushing in to get bonds or Sukuk done before the holiday period.
And that presumably is because they're not so much fear being buffeted by the winds of macroeconomics and geopolitical forces, but just because no one's going to be around for a month to buy the deals. Is that right? Everyone's going to be going on holiday?
Pretty much, yeah. It's not quite as extreme as the Christmas period in Europe or America, for example, where I think generally nobody is at work. You can still get stuff done in Ramadan. Last year was actually very busy, but that was because the banking wobble in March 2023 happened in the run-up to Ramadan, so that this run-up period that we've had this year was shut. But yeah, effectively it's pretty tough to get stuff done because there are no investors around, and one funding official actually said that also applies to the issuers because they have lots of people on holiday too, so all the decisions you have to make and all the work you have to do to issue a bond or to cook, you know, that becomes harder if fewer of your people are around.
Yeah, of course, because there was, you know, especially in Sukuk, there's a lot more sort of, I guess, structuring, I suppose, if you want to call it that. But there's that extra layer, isn't there, of Sharia compliance to adhere to, that's going to take a bit more work. Interesting aside, actually, I note you now call the banking crisis the banking wobble, which I know John will be grateful
for you doing. Yes, I applaud that.
I, however, still think of it as a crisis.
May we have more wobbles and fewer crises?
Well, yes, indeed.
Wobble, maybe.
Severe wobble. That will do. That will do. Oh, well, I mean, we talked a little bit then about the sort of differences between Sir Cook and the conventional bond market. They obviously appear to two different audiences. Sir Cook are there to be bought by Islamic investors with a particular mandate who can't buy conventional bonds. How is this recent spate of deals panning out in both of those markets?
Pretty well. Starting with Sir Cook, for the past 2 years, effectively, since energy prices soared after Russia invaded Ukraine, the Sir Cook market, there's been so much liquidity because of all the money flowing into that part of the world because of high energy prices. It ends up at banks, and they've got to do something with that money. And local banks, whether they're Islamic or not, you know, they really want, particularly the Islamic banks, they want to buy Sir Cook. Supply of Sir Cook is not that high compared with normal bonds. So effectively, it's a borrower's market. And particularly at this time when the primary market has been so strong for everything, Sir Cook is... It's never a free hit, but issuers do pretty well whenever they go to it. And bonds as well, there's still the strength that we've had in February and January. Books are quite big. Issuers down to sort of below investment grade or on the investment grade, sub-investment grade boundary have been getting big books, able to tighten to the extent that they've paid no new issue premium. So it's pretty strong in both markets.
It does seem, George, like the issuers in this region have a degree of flexibility about when they come to the market, don't they? And that's shown in the waves and ups and downs of how much is issued, which is perhaps a bit surprising when you think that, you know, most significant bond issuers, you know, they have debt to refinance, and they have, you know, when it needs to mature, they have to go and issue a new one. So how are they able to have this flexibility?
It's a good question. I think within CMIA, at least, it's the, when you think about credit ratings and just the fundamental strength of the issuers, it's probably the strongest part of CMIA. You know, lots of these issuers are A rated, some are even AA rated. They're just strong issuers who, if they don't have the opportunity to refinance the bonds, they can tide over for a certain period of time. They're not under pressure to refinance debt because they have the means to repay their bonds also cook without market access, I think would be the simplest answer. So they can, as a result, sort of time their issuance, unlike another issuer like Kenya, for example, earlier this year, that was under pretty severe pressure to issue and had to accept a very high price to do so.
And most of this is in dollars, isn't it? So it's really driven by the dollar yield curve and what's happening with that. And with the high yields in dollars at the moment, investors are being quite aggressive in buying, aren't they?
Exactly, yeah. I think with expectations that interest rates are going to start to be cut by central banks, including the Fed, investors know that this is the last chance they may get for some time to get coupons and yields sort of in the 5-6% area from, you know, really highly rated, strong issuers in the Middle East. I'm thinking of the banks, for example, which... they're offering coupons or profit rate, as it would be with a Sir Cook, several hundred basis points higher than a couple of years ago. Even though on a spread basis, sometimes they're actually pricing more lower. So, there's a sort of fear of missing out for investors that this is their last chance to really get such high prices.
And that's enabling the banks to get the tight spreads, and which is pulling them to the market.
It is, yeah. It's some of the books have been enormous, really.
Well, give us some examples, George, of some of these deals. That...
There was one that I cited in my story, actually, which was Dubai Islamic Bank, which issued a Sukuk on Monday, $1 billion 2029 Sukuk, and it priced at a spread of 95 basis points over US Treasuries, which is actually 5 basis points lower than 2021, when it sold a 5-year $1 billion Sukuk. But because of the big rise in US Treasury yields since then, the profit rate on that Sukuk this time around was 5.2% compared with just under 2% 3 years ago. So you can see the attraction for issuers in the spreads. They're actually, you know, landed at a lower spread than 3 years ago. But for investors, the coupon or profit rate in this case is much higher.
I got a question. Now, this sort of stellar performance that issuers can achieve, or sort of the stellar pricing that issuers can achieve in Sukuk, and that's not a recent thing. I remember we talked a lot last year about the sort of deals Turkey was able to do in Sukuk when it might have had a rather tougher time in the conventional bond market. That was before May's election last year, when a lot of people around the world thought President Erdogan's economic policy was completely out of whack. And it was having to borrow yields of sort of at or around or even over 10% in the bond market, or would have done. But it was able to bring much better Sukuk deals. So if there's this sort of structural imbalance of supply and demand, why don't more issuers do Sukuk?
It's not always possible for structural reasons. I think because of the way fixed income works in under Islamic law, if you don't have the right assets that are pulled together to be put into the Sukuk, you just can't do it. So there are sort of fundamental structural reasons to doing an Islamic bond that just prohibits some from doing it. It's not something everyone can do. It doesn't mean, you know, the obvious thought would be, you know, why wouldn't a European company just do a Sukuk? And they have, and they can. But it is much more difficult. And obviously there's all the Sharia compliance that you have to do as well. So yeah, on the face of it, you think, why isn't everyone just piling in? But they are more complex and more difficult to do than bonds.
Yeah, I mean, the assets question is interesting. I'm no particular expert on what counts as eligible assets, but of course many issuers have been able to find them to do when they wanted to do green bonds, for example.
It's a good analogy, Ralph, green bonds or even covered bonds, in that both of them require certain assets to be available. And, you know, when an issuer has them and has the inclination and the time to do it, they quite often take advantage of that. But if they haven't got those assets available, then, you know, they have to do ordinary funding. And I think that probably is why there is this structural imbalance built in, you know, which is good because it keeps the you know, it keeps issuers keen on this product.
I also wonder what the deal is like trying to get a deal to be Sharia compliant. If you want to sell a bond into the States and you want it to have, for example, what's known as Rule 144A documentation, where you can sell to certain onshore US investors, or if you want to go the whole hog and register the deal with the SEC, what's called a global bond, where literally anybody can buy it, then you have to make an enormous amount of disclosures and an awful lot of legal work. I wonder what the difference is there and whether that's prohibitive.
I think the thresholds are pretty high, and I think even some issuers of Sukuk who you might think would have no, you know, an Islamic bank, for example, that would have no problem, that only does Islamic banking, would have no problem setting up Sukuk. I think there have been deals in the past that the level of Sharia compliance has been questioned, and it is really difficult to meet those levels. So yeah, it's not something everyone can do.
I mean, the UK famously did a Sukuk, which I think it then refinanced 5 years later with another. I'm not sure what's happened to its Sukuk program since, but I don't know. It seems like a good way to keep down borrowing costs for the UK. That's for sure.
Yeah, South Africa did one quite recently too on the domestic market, which I think drew pretty huge demand.
I see. Okay, well, I don't know. Maybe we'll solve the missing Sukuk issue a mystery in further detail in another episode. I think it's interesting. The other burning question I have, of course, is, as you say, you know, it's a much bigger shutdown at Christmas because everyone just disappears for a week. But Ramadan, which will last for about a month, as of what is predicted to be, I think, March the 10th. Why don't these issuers just wait until after Ramadan?
They can, but I think what the last 2 years have taught everyone is that bad things that make the market much more difficult for issuers and investors can happen pretty much, you know, instantly, and no one knows how long they'll last. So they could wait, but a month is a long time, and who knows what the primary market's going to look like after Ramadan. Something could have happened that would shake it to the extent that even these really highly rated borrowers in the Gulf might not be able to issue a bond, or treasury yields would rise by a couple of tens of basis points, which for a lot of Gulf issuers, which are quite spread sensitive, they wouldn't, and spreads might widen, and those spread sensitive issuers might not want to issue after that. So the funding official we spoke to from Sharjah, the Emirate of Sharjah, which sold a sustainable bond this week, he said, you know, you want to get ahead of it because uncertainty just generally rises as the year goes ahead and you never quite know what's around the corner.